I'll be yeah. This session, I was. Well, let me just introduce a little bit of what I think I'm here for, and ask you what you're here for. So, can you just shout out, why are you here? Why have you taken this break away? What's it all about for you as a church? Sorry? I missed that altogether, sorry. You told you had to come, all right, that's a good reason. Good obedient. Okay, strongly encouraged to come. So you're here, don't know why you're here.
It's good to get away from stuff, to clear my head, to be honest,
yeah.
In my case.
Okay, so it's kind of getting away from just the routines of life and church life and having a bit of time to invest in one another, relationships, refreshment. I thought a long time of worship this morning, was that good?
Yeah.
It's lovely to walk into worship. So that's great. And I think those are all really good reasons to come away. I think that what I'm about, why I'm here, I'm here really as a friend of the bridegroom. Now, my daughter's getting married this summer. 24. Glad to get rid of her, frankly. No. No. She's getting married. And she is choosing a wedding dress. Has anyone done that? Oh, Derek's. Great. They are expensive. They're really expensive. And I guess my daughter Esther wants to look her best for her wedding day. And the reason she wants to look her best is not particularly because she's a kind of think she's, you know, a supermodel or because she wants to show off. She wants to look her best for Nathan, her fiancé, really. She does. She wants to look great because she's giving herself to him. Now, my feeling is that as a church, the whole church, but any local church, we should want to look good for the bridegroom. We should want to make ourselves attractive and pleasing to him. And so that there's all kinds of ways we can do that, I think. But for me, as I'm with you, I think my job is to help your thinking how we can be more pleasing for the bridegroom, how we can get ourselves ready, how we can look great. And I think my other kind of conviction is if we're pleasing to God, if we look great to Jesus, if he says, look at my church, doesn't she look fantastic? I think other people will look at the church and think she looks fantastic too. I mean, can you shout out some kind of model church you think, oh, I think Jesus would really like that church or that ministry or any things that attract, that you think are attractive to God? Yeah? Okay. HTV, Bethel, any others?
Iris Ministries,
yeah? Any others? Yeah. I think attractive churches, things that are pleasing God, that are in love with him and serving him, people actually want to join, don't they? You remember in the book of Acts where the church was doing all this amazing stuff, but even though there was persecution, and even though it was a bit scary because the Holy Spirit's power was there, people kept joining them. And I know that's on your heart. You want to grow to be all that you can be. So my first session was called Blessed to be a Blessing. It's a very familiar idea, isn't it? That when God blesses people, when God calls people and loves people, it's so that they can be a blessing to other people. And that's how the Bible story starts. It starts with God choosing a family, the family of Abraham, and saying, I'm going to bless you because I want you to be a blessing to the nations. I want you to carry my good news. I want you to be part of my rescue plan for the world. And we're kind of caught up in that too. We're still kind of children of Abraham. We're called to be a blessing. And if we're going to be a blessing, we're going to be a blessing because we are blessed. Because we've got something to bless with. We've got some resource. We've got some life. We've got some gift. We've got some grace. And I think that if we're going to be a blessing, it starts with being delighted in God. And are you? It's an open question, isn't it? Because sometimes you are and sometimes you aren't, probably. You know, it's kind of, maybe you can have an experience in your life of answered prayer or of a kind of environment where the Spirit of God seems to be really present, and you're kind of in love with Him, and you sense His Spirit's moving, and you're delighted. But that can be a bit dependent on circumstances. And I think that for us to be a blessing, we have to know in a very deep place that God is wonderful, that we're delighted with Him, and that He's delighted with us. And I suppose if we are children of Abraham, Abraham went through a fair few trials and difficulties, including, you know, the promise of a son not happening so well, and, you know, getting a bit caught up with kings of Egypt and other complications in life, and having his nephew nick all the best land. There's lots of stuff that happened to Abraham, but he kept that sense, that vision that God is the awesome, wonderful God who's called me and who I'm devoted to. And I think if we're going to be blessed to be a blessing, and we're really going to be delighted in God, so that it shows, then we need to have a really good secret history with God. Now, again, one of my convictions is that to be authentic is really important as a follower of Jesus. And that when we are a witnessing church, when we're a church that's wanting to reach out to communities and to our friends and neighbours, that authenticity will be fairly obvious to people. Actually, it's quite obvious to one another, aren't we? You probably, from time to time, kind of come alongside a Christian who talks the talk very well, but you feel on the inside, I'm not sure whether this goes very deep, whether this is just kind of cultural, whether they just know the right words to say, but you don't really necessarily feel that heart-to-heart connection. You don't always feel the family likeness with people. Do you have that kind of experience? I think if we're going to have integrity, we need to have a really good secret history with God. And just to unpack that a little bit more, the secret history that you have is the bit below the waterline in your life, the bit that you think and feel when in your most private moments, the things that direct your sense of identity and what you do, and they may not occupy a lot of time. And for me, when I was in my teens, my secret history was that I was a hippie rock star. I wasn't, actually. I'd like to have been. But it's kind of like my image, you know, Afghan coats, long hair, beads, a lot of time playing the guitar, you know, hanging out. And really, I had other things I needed to be doing with my life. But the thing that, the sort of world that I lived in, my inner world, was very much like that kind of world. And it had a profound effect on my identity and the way I did life. I mean, it could be all kinds of things that shape your identity. You know, it could be romance, it could be sport, it could be career things that you aspire to that dominate your secret life. Jesus talks about a secret history with God in Matthew chapter 6. And he's very much challenging, you know, the most religious people on the earth, probably, the Jewish people, with their whole very public religion, the very obvious worship, synagogue practice, fasting days, you know, the obvious religious garments, you know, the phylacteries, the tassels, all that sort of stuff. And he's calling them to a secret history with God. And there are a few things that Jesus says in Matthew 6 that we should do in secret. He says, you know, be careful not to do your acts of righteousness before men to be seen by them. If you do, you'll have no reward from your Father in heaven. So when you give to the needy, don't announce with trumpets. When you give to the needy, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. So your giving may be in secret. Your Father who sees what's done in secret will reward you. And it's not just giving, it's prayer and it's fasting. And it's forgiving people. It's a whole bunch of stuff that's just done for the Father. It's not done for any public prestige. It's not done to get religious brownie points. It's done to please the Father. And people who have a secret history with God really believe it. And I think if we're going to share our faith, if it's not founded on a secret history, it won't stand to much. In the New Testament, Some of the people had a secret history. It's just stuck with Jesus all the way through. You know, I think of his mother, Mary, where she pondered the things in her heart that the angel said to her, where she remembered the visitation she had from the angel. She heard the prophetic word from Simeon. It says she pondered stuff in her heart. She had all this stuff going on. And though we don't see a lot of her, she's all the way, she's there. She's there at the cross. She's there with the disciples on the day of Pentecost. She's had a secret history, and she believes it, and she doesn't fall away. There's a real contrast with Judas, who had a negative secret history. He was a bit of a thief. And that just opened a doorway for him to completely fall away and give in to the powers of darkness. So our secret history is really important if we're going to delight ourselves with God. You know, somebody who's the best salesman in the world is someone who really believes in their product. That's how it works, isn't it? And we're not selling a product. We're inviting people into a relationship with God. We're sharing our own good news. We're a beggar telling someone else where to get bread. And if we're going to be delighted in God, and if we know we need to grow in our love for him, I think cultivating a heart for him is really experiencing his mercy and really being aware of it for ourselves and for other people. You know, in Luke 7, it's the story of the woman who, in the house of the Pharisee, who doesn't give Jesus much of a welcome, she anoints Jesus' feet and pours perfume over him and weeps over him. And the Pharisee, who knows she's a, inverted commas, sinful woman, says, you know, if this man who's a prophet was really a prophet, he'd know what kind of woman is touching him. And Jesus kind of unpacks it with him, and then he says, tells a little parable, and then he says, she loves much. He who's been forgiven little loves little. Her many sins have been forgiven. She loves much, but he's been forgiven little loves little. I think for me, my whole conversion was really triggered by realizing that Jesus died for my sins. And I grew up in a home where I knew about Jesus, believed the stories about Jesus, believed in God. But my heart wasn't captured by him until I really realized that I needed to be forgiven, and Jesus' death on the cross was personal, it was for me. And so for me, an encounter with God's mercy for me unlocked my love for him. And as I've gone on in life, I find that encountering God's mercy for other people also unlocks my love for him. That when I see God touching, blessing, healing, restoring, forgiving people, and particularly when I get to join in with that, when I get to be used by God to bring his blessing to someone else, my love for him increases. Have you had that experience yourself? You know, when it's like you melt on the inside because you're just touched with the mercy of God, and you feel that mercy for God for you or for another. At one time in my life, I ran a day centre. Really, it was like a shopfront church in the inner city in Bristol for homeless people and inner city people of all kinds who had big needs. And every day, I would see God doing something because we had a bunch of volunteers and a bunch of resources where we could bless people. And it was just a wonderful experience, even though it was challenging at times, because most weeks there would be something that moved me to tears about the goodness of God breaking into someone else's life. And it helped my love grow. You know, and for me, I love prayer ministry. And I love praying for people because I love to see God blessing other people. And I love to kind of connect with his mercy. And here's a little freebie, really. We're allowed to join in God's mercy. We're not allowed to join in his judgment. You know how Christians can be sometimes, that we can be quite judgmental. And we can discriminate between people that we think deserve God's blessing and people who don't. And we can hold unforgiveness. You know, right the way through the Bible, it's considered really bad and foolish and sinful to join in with God's judgment. When Israel gets judged by God in the Old Testament, and the nations and the cities around join in, and they think, oh, this nation under the judgment of God will join in and we'll do a bit of pillaging and all that kind of thing. God judges those nations for judging Israel. In the New Testament, Jesus is emphatic. Don't judge, or you'll be judged. You know, which of you is without sin? Let him cast the first stone. Paul goes on about not judging. You know, leave it up to God. We are not in a position to judge. We don't see truly. We can make mistakes. And we're so compromised ourselves. How can we join in God's judgment? So we don't judge. But anyone can join in God's mercy. Anyone can do that. In fact, Jesus says, this is what we've got to do. When he sees the blind man in John chapter 9, and so I say, why is he blind? Maybe there's an act of judgment here. Maybe he sinned or his parents sinned. Jesus said, no. Actually, while it's day, we must do the works of him who sent me. Let's be a blessing. Let's join in with God's mercy. Let's heal him. And that is the whole tenor of the mission of the people of God. Let's join in with the mercy of God. Let's bless. And when we do that, our love for God is just so alive. Now, for me, one of the things that I want to share with you, as we're thinking about blessing to be a blessing, and for you as you've come away together, is that I want to think with you about all those people that you're connected with, that you have influence with, who are not part of Woodies in Cardiff, or are not part of any church. And you're probably very familiar with the famous quote of William Temple, the Anglican bishop, who said, "The church is the only society on earth that exists for the benefit of its non-members." Are you familiar with that quote? How does church actually work like that? Now, I grew up Methodist. Nothing wrong with that. My dad was a Methodist minister. And as I think about his life and his ministry, I think that what he really did, on the whole, was to serve the interests of the Methodist church that he was pastoring. That's kind of the expectation. You know, if there are people in hospital from the church or sick, my dad would visit them. And if there were people who needed to get married or have a funeral, or, you know, my dad would do a lot of preaching and communion, all that kind of stuff. And it wasn't that as a Methodist church we didn't want people to join us, but the energy was internal. And we're very happy to welcome people who like Methodist hymns and who like coming to church at 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning, and who like sitting in pews, and who like organ music, and a whole range of things that we liked, and it was what we'd inherited and what we grew up with, and that's the way you do it. But we were really, in effect, a club, and the people who were working for the church were servicing the needs of the members, primarily. That wasn't in my dad's heart, actually. He'd love to be an evangelist, really. But he kept being called back by his church, "You need to look after us." I think the job of a church leader or a pastor is actually to be more like a coach on a football team, or who is actually, our job is to equip people to do the works that God's called you all to. And we're really saying, we're the people of God, we're blessed to be a blessing. If we've got good things, it's so that we can give them away to other people who don't yet have. And that's what it means for us to love God and to love our neighbours as ourselves. And so, Woodville Baptist Church, Cardiff, I think, really exists for people who aren't part of Woodville Baptist Church. Do you agree with me on that one? What you need to seriously think to yourselves, as every church does, if that's true, if that's our prime reason, is, if you look at the evidence of our life together, is the number one thing that we're all about reaching people who are unchurched, people who don't know Jesus? Is that the top of our priority list? I've got an acquaintance called David Parker, who's a vineyard pastor in America, and he says, if reaching lost people is not your number one, it won't make it into your top 10 priorities because everything else will crowd it out. It needs to be really number one because otherwise our own needs will be so intrusive. And they're good needs, and it's not they're not important. You know, we want to have great teaching and great worship. We want to have great kids' work. You know, we want to care for the poor among us. We want to, I don't know, grow in the things of the Holy Spirit. There's lots and lots of things, but those things can overtake. You know, how many of you have been in a home group that says, well, we don't want to reach out to new people yet. We need to be discipled, and we need to be a safe place where we can really open up to one another. Do you know, that's kind of, if it's not number one of our needs, it probably won't be in the top 10. But does that mean we have to then become just a seeker church? Just to kind of think, well, you know, we have to relate to our culture and sort of be almost, well, so easy for people to join that we don't feel like we've got any passion or we're really church at all. I don't think it means that at all. I'm going to wind down for this one and just develop this in the next session. But one of my, again, real convictions is that church is meant to be a both and church. It's meant to be for seekers, yes, but it's also meant to be for disciples, and it should coexist. There are three kind of big pictures of church in the Bible. The first picture is the picture of the temple. The tabernacle and the temple are a place for God. They're a house for God. And when Moses builds a tabernacle and when Solomon builds a temple, they're places where God dwells, where God's presence is. And that's what they are. And it's a holy place. It's a scary place. We approach it with reverence and awe. But it's a house for God. And the second picture of church in Scripture is really the synagogue. Because the synagogue is where God's people met, and it was a house for people who belonged. And a synagogue ruler like Jairus, his job would be to keep people who were a bit unclean or who didn't quite belong or who were Gentiles or whatever, to keep them out. But the synagogue was a place for teaching and training and holding on to the Jewishness of the people of God. And so the synagogue, particularly when the nation of Israel was dispersed, the synagogue survived and it helped Jews be Jews. It was for people who belonged. But the third picture of church is just the church in the home, the early church, the churches that Paul and Peter and others planted. And that was a place for God. Because God was there. And it was a place for the community, because that's where the community gathered, the believers gathered to break bread and to care for one another's needs and to give their money to one another and to love one another and to be taught and discipled and listen to the apostles' teaching. But it's also a place for seekers. And that's why when Paul's describing the church of worship in 1 Corinthians, he says, you know, and if someone who doesn't understand or is not a believer walks in among you, it's important he doesn't think you're crazy. But what we're hoping is that he will fall down and say, God is really among you. Because it's a church for seekers. And so I want to think with you, what does a church that God finds attractive look like? What's a beautiful church? What's a radiant bride look like? And could it be that a radiant bride is someone that is really committed to God's purpose on earth, particularly blessing those who don't yet have, and that exists for the unchurched, but not to lead them where they are, but to see them right in the family of God, to become disciples of God, and that we need to find we can create a house that is a house for God, where his presence is strongly felt and experienced, just like you've been experiencing God's presence in worship today. There is a house for believers where we can be taught and discipled and grow and care for one another, but it's also a house where unchurched people, where people who don't yet believe, people who were far from God, can find their way in, can really belong, and can really get to know him. So we'll talk about that after coffee, shall we? Thank you.